Welcome to the second half of the show. I hope you enjoyed your break.
I did. Now, before Claude gets start with the plot description for the 1987 No Way Out, here's a trivia question for you. As Claude is going to mention, A, Kevin Costner appears in this movie, and B, this is a Cold War movie. Now, about a decade after this movie came out, Costner and Roger Donaldson, the director of this movie, teamed up to make another Cold War era movie, this one a docudrama about the Cuban Missile Crisis. What was the name of that movie? Well, I'll give you the answer to that at the end of this half of the episode. But for now, Claude is going to give us the plot description for the 1987 No Way Out.
Yes, indeed. So we open with aerial shots of Washington, D.C. that move away from the city and into the suburban areas, finally settling on what we later learn is a safe house. Inside, U.S. Navy Lieutenant Commander Tom Farrell, played by Kevin Costner, is being interrogated by two men about how he first met Secretary of Defense David Brice. Flashback to several months earlier. Farrell is invited to an inaugural ball in Washington, D.C. by his college buddy Scott Pritchard, who's played here by Will Patton. Pritchard wants to introduce him to Brice, and Pritchard hopes that Brice will transfer Farrell to the Pentagon. On meeting Farrell, Brice, who's played by Gene Hackman, is unimpressed and pretty much ignores him. Shortly thereafter, Farrell begins flirting with another guest named Susan Atwell, and she's played by Sean Young. The two have sex in her limousine, and a little later at the apartment of Nina Bika, played by Iman. She's a friend of Susan's, and even though she's admitted to Farrell that she is also involved with a married man. The next day, Farrell bids her goodbye at the airport and on his way back to active duty, but their one night of passion has clearly had some profound romantic effects on both of them. While at sea, Farrell single-handedly rescues a crewman from being washed overboard during a storm. Brice reads a newspaper story about the rescue and orders Farrell transferred from the Philippines to his intelligence staff. Farrell returns to Washington, and his first order of business is spending some time with Susan, where he learns that the married man she's been seeing is Brice. The next day, Brice and Pritchard, who is Brice's second in command, orient him to his new assignment, which involves getting secret information from other government agencies, such as the CIA, and passing it on to Brice. Farrell also finds out that now and then he'll be working with Dr. Sam Hesselman, who's played by George D'Zunza, an old friend who is now working at the Pentagon's new computer center as its chief programmer analyst. Sometime later, Susan and Farrell spend a romantic weekend in Annapolis, staying at an historic inn and renting a boat after bribing the rental agents to get a boat that's otherwise unavailable. Shortly after, they return to her place late at night. Brice visits her unexpectedly, and Susan has to urge Farrell to leave through the back door, which of course has him angry and jealous, but she assures him that she loves him and she is going to leave Brice. Brice sees a man leaving Susan's house, but he cannot see that it was Farrell. After Susan lets him in, Brice demands to know the name of her other lover, but Susan refuses to tell him, and she orders him to leave. Brice becomes enraged, he slaps her several times, and during the argument, he accidentally pushes her over an upstairs railing. She crashes through a glass table and is instantly dead from a broken neck. Brice then rushes to Pritchard's apartment and tearfully confesses what has happened, stating he is ready to turn himself in because he had been seen by Susan's other lover, but Pritchard suggests that if the other man is made out to be a suspected Russian KGB sleeper agent, codenamed Yuri, well then Susan's death could be made a matter of national security, and Yuri could be killed in the line of duty by operatives under Pritchard's control. Pritchard goes to Susan's house and he clears it of all the evidence that Brice was ever there, and during his cleanup he discovers the negative of a Polaroid photograph that Susan had taken of Farrell earlier. So some CID officers, commanded by Major Donovan, played by Jason Bernard, scour Susan's apartment for evidence, and when they return to catalog everything they've collected, Pritchard slips the negative among the items brought in by the agents. Initially, the negative seems to be too faint to reveal a picture, but Dr. Hesselman has some brand new software that has a means of enhancing these things called pixels on the negative to potentially resolve the image into a coherent picture. And using these powerful supercomputers that the Pentagon has, well, it will take a week tops to do the job. Meanwhile, Farrell slowly becomes convinced that Bryce is the actual murderer and that Pritchard is helping him cover up the crime. At the same time, he becomes aware that the most valuable pieces of evidence so far accumulated would make him the prime suspect. Farrell determines to play along with the bogus investigation until he can develop evidence linking Bryce to Susan so that he can defend himself against being charged with both murder and espionage as Yuri. Farrell learns that one piece of evidence is a Moroccan jewel box that he had seen earlier, a gift to Susan from Bryce. Now, since any foreign gift has to be registered with the State Department, Farrell gets Hesselman to raid the State Department's computerized registry of such items, which should link the gift to Bryce by name. Pritchard finds an address book of Susan's with Nina's name in it. When Pritchard and Farrell go to Nina to get information about Susan's men, she pretends not to recognize Farrell, but Pritchard learns she has heard the name Bryce. Pritchard sends two former CIA assassins to eliminate her, but Farrell figures out that that's their destination, so he races from the building and he engages the assassins by crashing their car and leading them on a chase through the nearby neighborhood before finally escaping into the subway. He gets to the mall, where Nina works ahead of the assassins and warns her to get genuinely lost for a while. She gets away safely, but now the assassins have caught up with him and they take him back to the Pentagon. This activity solidifies Pritchard's suspicions of Farrell's loyalty to Bryce and himself, as well as his motives for attempting to disrupt the cover-up. Farrell confides to Hesselman that he and Susan were in love and that he's the person in the photograph, which still hasn't resolved into anything coherent. It's only been a couple of days. He convinces Hesselman to delay the enhancement work on the photograph while he gathers evidence to prove his innocence. He also gets Hesselman to enter the jewelry box into the State Department's gift database since that was missing. Around the same time, CID officers bring in two witnesses who saw Yuri with Susan during their romantic weekend. One of the witnesses spots Farrell in the Pentagon corridors and recognizes him at a distance. The CID begins a search of the Pentagon on the grounds that Yuri is somewhere in the building, using the witnesses to identify him. Farrell eludes the search and tells Hesselman that Bryce had slept with and killed Susan. Thinking that Farrell is delusional, Hesselman tells Pritchard about Farrell's relationship with Susan and his belief that Bryce murdered her. Pritchard thanks Hesselman and then shoots him in cold blood. Still trying to avoid the search, Farrell returns to Hesselman's office, where the printout of State's registry has linked the jewel case with Bryce. He confronts Bryce with this evidence and threatens to go to the police if the search is not called off. After Donovan reports that Hesselman has been murdered by Yuri, Pritchard tells Bryce that Farrell was Susan's lover, then adds that if the man in the photo is Yuri, then Farrell must be Yuri, and Bryce will still be in the clear because Pritchard will claim that Bryce was at his home the night Susan was killed. But Bryce knows that Farrell has the printout, so he improvises a different story. How about this? Pritchard, who is homosexual, killed Susan because he was jealous of Bryce's relationship with her. Well, Pritchard is devastated by this, and he eventually shoots himself in the head. When the guards break in, Bryce tells Donovan that Pritchard was Yuri, and the search for the spy and the murderer is effectively over. Farrell leaves the office and the Pentagon, but not before sending the printout via courier to the director of the CIA, who is one of Bryce's enemies. Minutes later, the finished image enhancement of the photograph positively reveals Farrell as Susan's lover. We see Farrell mourning at Susan's grave when a couple of men flank him and escort him to their car. They turn out to be the ones who were interrogating him at the beginning of the film. We learn that this safe house is a KGB safe house and that Farrell actually is Yuri. He's a Russian mole in the Department of Defense. The KGB ordered Farrell to seduce Bryce's mistress to gather intelligence from her. Farrell's handler is revealed to be his quirky artist landlord, Mr. Schiller, who is played by Michael Shiloh, who tells Yuri that America is no longer safe for him and that it is time for him to return to the Soviet Union. But Farrell refuses, saying he genuinely fell in love with Susan and he's done with being a spy. As Farrell leaves the safe house, the two Russian agents want to chase after him, but his handler stops him and says he'll return Where else does he have to go? And we end with another aerial view of the safe house as Farrell gets into a car and drives away, and the shot follows the car as it moves through the neighborhood, then it pans over the rather close by Pentagon and back over Washington, D.C.
Okay, now before I discuss the movie in detail, including what it's based on, I have a personal note to interject here. I saw this movie when it came out in theaters. Matter of fact, the second day it opened, I saw it on a Saturday. It opened on a Friday in August of 1987. And I was 19 years old at the time. Now, obviously, my critical faculties at the time were nowhere near as sophisticated as they are now, simply because I'm older, wiser, and have seen a lot more movies since then. But even at that age, I knew that there were certain Hollywood conventions to be followed. For example, 2 years before No Way Out came out, Kevin Costner was in a Western called Silverado, although he played a supporting character in that movie. Scott Glenn played the main character, the main hero. And about halfway through the movie or so, the bad guys waylay him until he's rescued by Danny Glover and brought to a cave where Glenn's character can hardly stand up, even by the time that Glover returns to him after going out for reasons that are important to the movie, but not to the story. And then Glover happens to tell Glenn that his young nephew was kidnapped by the bad guys. Even at 17 years old, which is how old I was when Silverado came out, I knew that Glenn was all of a sudden going to find a second wind and get up as if nothing had happened to him so he could go and get the bad guys and rescue his nephew. So the fact that a Hollywood movie, and yes, I had seen Platoon, which had come out several months earlier, but I didn't really consider that a Hollywood movie at the time, even though now I recognize there are certain Hollywoodish elements in it. I never dreamed that the Hollywood movie would pull the rug out from under you the way this movie does in revealing that the guy who you've been told throughout and shown throughout as a hero throughout was actually a bad guy. And that came as a total shock to me, as it did for the audience that I saw it with in the theater. And, you know, I still don't know how I was able to ride my bike all the way home from the theater because I was in such a state.
So do you remember, like, the audience reaction? Was it audible or?
Yes.
Okay.
There was a lot of murmuring and gasping around. And a guy who I went to high school with at the time I saw coming out, and we were both like, wow. So did you see this in the theater, Claude? Or?
I did not. I did see it sometime afterward. Like, I guess it was on HBO or something. And so I was, taken in by the story and rooting for him all the way. And then, as you say, the rug got pulled out and I was like, oh, wow. I think that was my initial reaction. Just wow.
Yes. So now let's talk about I'm going to talk a little later about the reasons why that ending works so well and how it was set up so well. But first, let's get into the background of the movie. This is based on a novel from the 1940s called The Big Clock, written by Kenneth Fearing. Fearing was known best as a poet, but he did write some novels, although none of them did as well as The Big Clock. Now, the story of The Big Clock is actually set at a media conglomerate back when You know, there were dozens of newspapers and magazines that were able to make money, you know, unlike today. And the Bryce character in that movie, or in that novel, I should say, because it was made into a movie, but the Bryce character is the owner of this conglomerate, and his name in the movie, his name in the novel is Earl Janeth, and the Tom Farrell character is a writer for the conglomerate by the name of George Stroud. And the woman, the Susan character, is named Pauline, and the Scott Pritchard character is named Steve Hagen. Now, the interesting thing about the novel is that even though novels weren't allowed to be very explicit either, this is before the obscenity case regarding Allen Ginsberg's Howl that declared poetry and novels, even those that may have used obscene language, as being protected by the First Amendment, but novels weren't allowed to use obscene language, and certainly not allowed to depict gay behavior, or actually depict LGBT characters explicitly. There are certainly a lot of hints in the novel, or at least hints, that the character of Pauline is bisexual, and the character of Earl Janeth is also bisexual, and that Steve is a gay character. Steve Hagen is a gay character, which his character being gay is carried over in the movie of No Way Out. And the Earl Janeth being bisexual is carried over in the movie with Bryce, but Susan being a bisexual, that is cut out completely for some reason. I'm not sure why. But the sexuality is there in the novel, and although there is no twist ending in the novel like there is in No Way Out, George is hired, the Farrell character, George is hired to investigate who killed Pauline. And yes, all the circumstantial evidence points to him, even though Janeth is the one who killed her. And there is a hint of George having, well, more than a hint of George having a secret life, and the fact that he's an alcoholic, which Fearing apparently was in real life. And when George is trying to push away any possible suspicion about him, he tries to imply that Pauline's murder had political implications, which is kind of interesting in lieu of how No Way Out turned, what No Way Out turned out to be. Now, The Big Clock was later turned into a movie of the same name, directed by John Farrow, Mia Farrow's father, and featured Ray Milland in the George Stroud role, Charles Laughton, who played a lot of villains in his career, as Janeth, George McCready, who also played quite a few villains in his career, as Steve Hagen, and Rita Johnson as Pauline. Johnson did Her most well-known movie, aside from this, was Here Comes Mr. Jordan, which was later remade as Heaven Can Wait and also as Down to Earth. But the movie does tone down a lot of the, you know, unsavory parts of the novel, although it does give a good character to Elsa Lanchester, who plays an artist who supplies an alibi for George Stroud's character. And she gets a very good scene where she meets someone from the magazine and she says, "It's nice to meet you. I've been dreaming of killing you for years." but it's a good movie, but it's not as good or as noir-filled as No Way Out, even though No Way Out changes a lot from the novel, you know, by moving the setting, by making it a Cold War movie, by changing the character names and what they do for a living. It does nevertheless feel more like a film noir, even though it's also a thriller, than the movie version of The Big Clock. Have you seen the movie version of The Big Clock?
I did, actually. And excuse me, I like the Big Clock. It's definitely got noir feel to it. And at the same time, it's almost got like a comedy feel to it. Everybody's like very snappy with the dialogue, and so it's an interesting story. And you're right, it goes in slightly different places, and it's got a little bit more Hays Code to it than No Way Out, of course, because you're not going to depict homosexuality, or at least you're not going to predict it to present it in an outward fashion, and you're not going to do that with bisexuality. And the bad guys have to get theirs, and so Sean Lawton's character actually dies at the end because he's the bad guy, and so he's got to get his.
Which, to be fair, is consistent with the novel.
Yeah. So, whereas No Way Out's got a little bit more ambiguous, you know, good guys versus bad guys and who winds up dying in this film. You know, it's kind of interesting in that specific respect. But yeah, it's kind of interesting because I don't necessarily know that, like, there's a lot of similar elements to both of these films. And at the same time, I don't know that I would have drawn a direct A to B line between Big Clock and No Way Out as one being a remake of the other.
Well,
or even a reimagining, you know?
Yeah, it's two different versions of the same source material.
That's a good way of framing it.
That's how I see it. And I do like The Big Clock. I just don't like it nearly as much as I like No Way Out.
Fair enough.
Although I will say that...
Here's what you say. You can like both.
That's not what I was going to say, but that is a good point. What I was going to say is that, you know, unfortunately... You know, the gay character turns about to be a villain is a stereotype that has cropped up in a lot of movies and continued for a while into the 80s and even later than that. And that's not helped by when the CIA director, who, by the way, is played by Fred Dalton Thompson, mm-hmm. who was a U.S. senator and who later became known as playing the DA on Law and Order. But when he has his exchange with O'Brien, who is played by the guy who is the liaison with the intelligence community, who's played by Leon Russom, mm-hmm. that Farrell meets with when O'Brien is speculating that Susan was either Bryce's or Pritchard's mistress. Marshall says, and you can forget about Pritchard, he's homosexual, and Brian is surprised by that, and he says, I'll be damned. And Marshall says, well, so is he if you believe the Old Testament.
Yeah.
You know, that's a line that I could have done without. But I must say that Will Patton plays him very well, and without going into the stereotype of playing a gay character.
Oh, yeah, he definitely soft pedals it. You know, there's the scene when Bryce comes into his apartment and starts telling him what happened, and there's a moment where Pritchard actually like puts his hands on Bryce's shoulders and like starts to like give him a shoulder rub a little bit, and I was like, what's up with this guy? Because this is not just like a calming technique. It's like there's something else going on here, and that's really it. You kind of leaves it
actually. Actually, before that, there's also a little hint. When Bryce is getting ready to go out with Susan, when Farrell is at her townhouse apartment and she shows him the gift from the Moroccan ambassador that proves to be crucial, and I'm going to get back to that in a moment, when Bryce is telling Scott why he likes Susan so much, and after Scott says, you know, says something like, yes, I'm to pick her up at this time if she remembers, Bryce immediately zeroes in on, you don't like Susan very much, do you? And then he says, you know, this woman can do things for me that no other woman has been able to. And then he looks at Scott directly and says, it's the only other thing worth living for. And he winks at him.
Yeah. Yeah. And actually, you're right. And it's a nice subtle scene because not only is he winking, but it's an upstage wink. You can, you, if you're not looking carefully, you won't see him do it.
Yeah. So,
but other than that, and then you've got, like you said, you know, Fred Dalton Thompson like coming right out and saying, yeah, he's a homosexual. But other than that, no, he's not like gaying it up at all, which is fine.
Right. And, you know, at first, you know, you do think he's this good guy because he wants Costner on the team. He is advising Bryce on how to deal with the phantom sub that Senator Duvall is pushing. And I don't know if you mentioned this in the synopsis, but Senator Duvall is played by Howard Duff.
I did not.
A character actor who it was in one of his last roles before he passed away. You might remember him best as Dustin Hoffman's lawyer in Kramer versus Kramer. But anyway, he's advising him on that. When Farrell has his first meeting with O'Brien, and he pulls that really neat move where he pretends that he's overworked, and Pritchard is like, well, is this the same guy I pushed so hard to hire? And then Farrell comes back when O'Brien is leaving with, actually, Kevin, if you don't mind, could you bring those estimates next time? It's a really clever move. And then Pritchard compliments him after O'Brien leaves. And then after the murder, you know, Pritchard, you know, he does all of the acts that he does in the movie, no matter how despicable, because he wants to protect Bryce.
Yeah.
You know, so even though he's a villain, he's doing it for what in his mind are the right reasons. He's trying to cover up to save his boss and the man that he's in love with.
Right, and that's one of the things, right, but that's also one of the things that makes him a good villain is, you know, he's not a mustache twirler. He basically, he is viewing himself as the hero of the story here. You know, and so he, you know, there are definite bad guys out there who behave like bad guys just to be bad guys, and he views himself as a hero here. In no way is what he's doing, you know, considered a bad thing in his own head.
And of course, though he never learns it, he does happen to be right about the fact that Farrell is Yuri.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's a nice little irony there as well. Now, I mentioned the details. The script was written by Robert Garland, whose other best-known credit was the Robert Redford, Jane Fonda, Sidney Pollack movie, The Electric Horseman, which is not something that would have prepared me for how good the script is. I mean, it's not a bad movie by any means, but this is up to a whole another level here, because there are all kinds of details introduced in the movie in the early part that pay off in a huge way once the thriller part kicks in. You know, there's the exchange for between Scott and between Pritchard and Farrell after they meet. He introduces Farrell to Bryce at the party, and Bryce is very dismissive of him. And Farrell says, you know, he shows great warmth, and Pritchard says he's a genius.
Yeah.
You know, the rules don't operate. And Farrell comes back with, you know, some people would say that you're the real genius. And yeah, in the second half of the movie, Pritchard is the real genius who comes up with not only the plot, but when Senator Duvall comes back to make noise about the Phantoms, about the fact that Bryce is running his own investigation, it's Pritchard who puts out that fire by saying, Senator, we're not locked in any position on the Phantom sub. And that, since the Phantom sub is Senator Duvall's pet project, he backs off. And then, you know, Pritchard says to Farrell in that beginning scene, you know, if it comes to it, I'd lay down my life for that man, which he does.
Which he does.
And then also the gift of the Moroccan, the gift that the Moroccan ambassador gave to him, the bag of underwear that when Farrell and the guy that he saved off the ship, when they're walking around in the Philippines, the bag that the kid offers to carry for Farrell, and he steals anyway, and Farrell stops his friend saying, hey, listen, it's just a pair of skivvies. Where's the harm there? And then at the end, Schiller, his Russian handler, says, you know, in the Philippines, when you passed along that bag of underwear, Moscow wasn't amused.
Right.
So, you know, I didn't pick up on that until the second time I saw the movie. I was like, oh, yeah.
It was a handoff. Okay.
Yeah. And then, you know, the Polaroid, even the fact that Susan says at the party, you know, my date, when Farrell says, let's get out of here, my date will hate it, but what the hell, his wife will be thrilled. And then when Farrell tries to call her from the Philippines, that's when we find out that Bryce is involved with her.
Right, right, right.
So all sorts of little details. And then, you know, we see at the very beginning of the movie the camera through the two-way mirror when Farrell is being questioned. And we forget all about it because of what's going on at the end, going on in the movie. And then at the very end, we see a guy standing by the back of him, standing by the camera behind the two-way mirror. And then we remember, all right, this is being filmed. And who's filming it? Now, when Costner was on Inside the Actors Studio, hosted by the late, great James Lipton. And yes, I know he could be very much, always pouring on the syrup or whatever in his interviews. But he did talk about craft, and he did get people to admit to things about themselves in a non-salacious manner. And he did get them talking about movies. And he asked Costner about No Way Out in the one-hour edited version of the much longer session that was undoubtedly done. And Costner said that if he had to do the movie over again, that he actually would have pushed harder for the movie to disguise the ending. And the only scene that I can think of that he's talking about is the scene where he goes to the bathroom to avoid the guys who are watching him. One of them, by the way, is played by Marshall Bell. The other one is played by a guy named in the name of Chris D. While he goes to the bathroom, and then he sneaks out of the bathroom and goes into the lobby to call someone from a payphone. And he says, "Do you know who this is?" You know, he says, "I need to talk to you." And he says, "Oh, I can't talk long. You know, they may be listening on the damn payphone already." And then he says, "I'll see you soon." Now, on the one hand, I can understand how for Costner that might be a giveaway scene. When I showed the movie to my best friend at the time, when that scene came, my friend was sort of puzzled by it. Mm-hmm. And I thought he was going to guess the ending. And I must admit, when I saw the movie the second time, which was at Gonzaga, where they used to show movies for free in the auditorium that they had there, after they had been in theaters in a while, but before they came out on video cassette, yes, the days of video cassette and the days of a long time between theatrical release and video release. But my friend was sort of confused by that at first. But he did talk himself into thinking, okay, Farrell was probably contacting the CIA. And we do get enough of a buildup of that being a red herring as to who he's really contacting, because, you know, we get O'Brien, when he's meeting with Marshall, mentioning the fact that, you know, even though Pritchard had chased O'Brien out of the meeting with Farrell after the murder has been committed, that he offers Farrell a private number that he can call anytime. And Farrell says, and O'Brien says to Marshall that Farrell looked like he wanted to have a heart to heart. And he then Farrell sends away the Navy guy with the evidence that the gift from the Moroccan ambassador was declared to the State Department's Office of Protocol. And he tells them to give it to Marshall and wake him up if he has to. So there is enough of a red herring that that scene does have the implications that maybe he was calling the CIA. But on the other hand, I do understand, you know, maybe that scene is the one scene that might give away too much.
Yeah, I guess I was in your friend's position as well. Is like I really was puzzled at first, and like who could he be calling here? Like, who does he know at this point? And I was like, it couldn't be Nina, could it? No. And then I remembered that, you know, A, he wanted to talk that out of the fella, and B, he had the phone number that, and there was somebody that he said, like, you know, I'll answer whatever time of the day or night, basically. And I said, okay, well, he's got a few other contacts that he could conceivably be calling. I guess the only thing that might have given away that it wasn't either of those guys is that he dialed the phone number from memory. And that would have been about it. Can I mention also one more like character decision, I guess, that Costner does? And this is like really interesting because I caught it right away, like in the very first viewing, and I thought it was like one of the funniest things I had seen. And then I realized he was doing it repeatedly through the film, is in the first scene, in the party scene, okay? He comes in, and one of the things he does is there's like waiters walking around with the champagne glasses on the trays. He doesn't take the champagne glass off the tray. He grabs it off the table. He takes somebody's champagne, and he's walking around with somebody else's glass and drinking from it. And you see him do it again later on. He goes into somebody's office to borrow the phone, and while he's on the phone, he picks up their coffee mug and drinks out of it. He goes, oh, wait, what's this? And puts it back down, which actually kind of sets up his picking up and then accidentally on purpose knocking over the glass of whatever was in that. Was it coffee again? I don't remember.
Yes.
Where he knocks it over and gets it all over his pants, and now he has to go change his clothes. That's his excuse for getting out of the computer room.
Right. But in addition to the details that play out, there are also scenes that we see here that take on a whole different meaning once you know the ending.
Yeah.
You know, for the fact that he goes to warn Nina. You know, at first you think, oh, he's making sure that she doesn't get killed. Although, of course, making sure that she doesn't reveal to the fact that she knows that Tom was involved with Susan as well. But after the ending, you know that if Scott found out that, he might put two and two together and realize that Tom is Yuri, which he does. Mm-hmm. And so he's trying to prevent that as well. And there's also the, you know, all the ways that he tries to stop Sam or push him in a different direction. Everything he's telling him is the truth.
Yeah.
You know, that, you know, he was in love with Susan or he was posing as her lover anyway, and that, you know, he had nothing to do with her death, that all this is a cover-up, that Bryce killed her. All that is true.
Sure.
But the reason why he's pushing Sam toward that is to keep him from being exposed as Yuri, not just of being falsely accused of murder.
Sure, and another thing that actually...
that's a nice little twist.
Yeah, another thing that actually occurred to me is let's come back on Nina for a moment. And I think she was sort of on the inside too, because here's the thing, like he gets to her and he tells her, you've got to get out of here, you've got to get gone, you've got to stay gone. And she's like, okay. She just says, she doesn't question it. Like, it's like basically, we're blown. We need to get out of here and go away.
I don't agree with that. You know, she does know that she has to get away, but she is questioning. She's saying, you know, what's going on? What happened? And Tom says there's no time to explain. But what I will say is when he and Pritchard first go to her apartment to mm-hmm. tell her that Susan has died, you know, the way that he addresses her formally lets her know, okay, we don't know each other. And then she gives these looks to Farrell a couple of times. And then he says, he's shaking his head when Pritchard brings up the fact that she's South African and that she's a refugee from there, which would mean, I mean, being a refugee from anywhere still unfortunately means a lot now, but it would have meant a refugee being from South Africa would have meant a hell of a lot more back then when we're still during the apartheid era. And so that threat carried a lot of weight. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we see Tom shake his head a little when she stares at him after Pritchard brings up the fact that she's South African. And then when Pritchard is trying to get her to say who was the man she'd been seeing, that Susan had been seeing, you see him start to take flowers out of a flower pot as if he's going to smash it over his head. And then after Pritchard decides to cut the interrogation short, And he starts to leave, and Tom comes up to her and says very formally, "Thank you very much, Ms. Beeka. You've been most helpful." You know, there's a lot of coding going on, mm-hmm. which I thought was very well written.
I still think she was kind of, because the other thing is, you know, if his mission is to get close to Susan, right? Well, how do they find out that Susan is Bryce's mistress? Because that was a very, very closely kept secret at this point. And the only person that Susan had told was Nina. So I still think she's in on it.
Okay. Well, anyway, now one other aspect of the movie got a lot of notoriety aside from the ending, and that's that sex scene in the limousine between Tom and Susan when they first meet each other, particularly how explicit it is. And by the way, apparently the dialogue between Tom and the limo driver was improvised. And it does sound very, the limo driver, by the way, is played by an actor by the name of Gordon Boyd, who at the time was billed as Gordon Needham. But anyway, about that sex scene, while I've said that there's a lot more to the 1980s than the accepted narrative of it being dominated by blockbuster movies and dominated by conservative thinking movies, I will certainly concede that the 80s were a lot more conservative about sex and how it was shown in movies than the 70s were, after the old Hays Code had been dumped in favor of the Motion Picture Association of America, or as it is now known, the Motion Picture Association Code, had allowed. And one of the ways was a fact that in a lot of horror and thriller movies, and we're going to talk about the movie that sort of introduced this in a future episode, the original version of Halloween, in a lot of those types of movies, that if a woman had sex and enjoyed it, that meant that she would get killed off at some point in the movie. In an article in American Film Magazine that came out some time after No Way Out did, a writer called them "fucking die movies." Okay. Now, the movie that she showed as the biggest illustration of that was Fatal Attraction, which is a movie I do not like except for Glenn Close's performance. But I will draw a distinction between something like Fatal Attraction and No Way Out. In Fatal Attraction, when Glenn Close does die at the end, you're being primed to root for her to die, to be killed. Whereas with Susan, I think you're supposed to be horrified by what happened. And clearly, when Bryce went over to confront her in the apartment, he did not mean to kill her at all. Now, in light of how many woman characters have gotten killed in movies and TV over the years, that might not seem like so much of a distinction to people, and I can understand that. Nevertheless, I don't think that she was killed because she had sex. And again, we're not meant to root for that to happen.
No, I think you're right. She, you know, you are meant to be horrified. And I think you get that specifically because the second she lands, we got a close up on her face and she's dead, lying on the floor. The eyes are open and staring. And we hold on that shot for a few seconds. You know, we're like kind of waiting for her to, like, you know, just like moan or turn her head or something. And nope, ain't happening. And then we get a couple of different, we come back to her face a couple of times where she is absolutely dead and staring, and that's the way it is. And there's even, at one point, there's an overhead shot looking down on her in this pose that she was in. As soon as she hit that table, neck was broken, she's dead, and she's just the limp old ragdoll there. And yeah, we are not set up to think that, you know, she got hers for being a woman who enjoyed sex. She was just, you know, it, like, wrong place, wrong time. She was an absolute victim in this particular case.
Right. Now, another interesting choice there is during that entire buildup to her murder, there's no music.
Yeah.
You know, it doesn't come in until after. And the score, by the way, is done by veteran composer Maurice Jarre, who's probably best known for his work with David Lean. But it's a terrific score, and it helps keep suspense throughout.
I'll say for the most part, it's a terrific score, because I do like Jarre's work, especially with Lawrence of Arabia. But the only place I didn't like it was in the opening credits, because it was just too much right away. You know, I understand it's going to be a suspenseful movie, but the thing is, you get this like, and then the title appears, and it's like, big sting. And I was like, what the hell, man?
It's an overture. You know, that's how a lot of scores are. It's an overture to what's coming next. So I don't mind that so
I just
much.
Think
the
like,
song.
Just that one sting right there as the title appeared just seemed to be a bit
too much. The music that I didn't like was the song that's playing during the sex scene in the limo. It's a power ballad co-sung by Paul Anka. And it's the title track, and it's very, very on the nose lyrically, like a lot of songs in the 80s were. So that, although it didn't take me out of the scene, I was like, all right, I could have done without that.
Okay.
Now, getting back to the visuals for a moment, this was the very last movie of cinematographer John Alcott, whom the movie is dedicated to. Now, he and Donaldson and the editors, William Hoy and Neil Travis, except for when Susan is killed, don't do a lot distinctively visually. You know, there's not a lot of fancy camera moves or fancy camera angles or things like that. But as I've said before, cinematography is not just about that. It's also knowing how to hold shots and how to block the people or the objects within those shots. And how to, not just when you're making a thriller, not just editing the thriller scenes, but everything else. And no scene illustrates that better, I think, or few scenes illustrate that better than in the scene where Pritchard admits to Farrell that Susan was sleeping, that Bryce was sleeping with Susan, that she was his mistress. And, you know, when we first see that, they go into somebody's office and Pritchard is like, leave us, please, to whoever was in there. And Farrell says, you haven't told me everything here. And if you'll notice, Pritchard is leaning against a wall with his back to the wall. And then later in the scene, as Farrell starts to question Bryce's alibi and whether or not he should, you know, go in front of the FBI or whoever, and Pritchard goes from being very conciliatory toward him to very hard-edged, saying that decision is not for you to make. And then he says, you know, if you do anything to try and implicate Bryce in this, I'll have no choice to try and stop you. And the camera cuts to Farrell, and now his back is against the wall.
He's in a corner.
Yes. So that's a very good visual way of illustrating who has the upper hand from the beginning of the scene towards the end of the scene.
Yeah. And I think one of the other things that cinematography is meant to do is like also, you know, pull your eye toward the thing that you are expected to see. So, for instance, in the scene where he goes into the subway. By the way, that's the Baltimore subway. It's not the...
Yes, I was going to mention that that is a geographical
Baltimore
blooper there.
MTA there. But the scene where he emerges from the subway and into the mall, which is, believe it or not, that's the old post office pavilion in D.C. It's not the Georgetown Mall, which you might have thought. But it's a very, very long shot of basically not the entire mall, but a big chunk of it. And he comes out of this doorway way into the back and you still see him. And I think that's one of these places where, you know, good cinematography really like draws. I'm sure he's like the one guy dressed in white, but still, you know, that you spot him as soon as he emerges from this door, even though he is no more than, you know, a couple of specks on your screen, and moves his way through the crowd and then, you know, up the stairway and so forth, and you're able to stay with him the entire time, even though he is in this very crowded space going on.
Right. Now, we should give credit to Donaldson for all this as well. Now, he's another one of those directors who's had a very up and down career. Now, there have been the good ones like Smash Palace, which is a divorce drama that was the first movie that brought him to critics' attention here. He is a New Zealand director, by the way. He directed the first New Zealand movie to ever be released outside of New Zealand, a movie called Sleeping Dogs with Sam Neill and Warren Oates.
Now, would that be the reason we get that scene with the Maori dancers doing the haka?
Yes.
Okay.
During the second party that Farrell attends,
right.
That Susan is attending with Bryce. Well, not together, but yeah. Anyway, yes, he put that in there. But, you know, Smash Palace is good. The Bank Job with Jason Statham. That's one of the few movies with Statham in it that I actually like, and it's a gleefully nasty movie. And then The World's Fastest Indian with Anthony Hopkins. And Indian, by the way, does not refer to a Native American. It refers to a brand of motorcycle. And that was a movie that was based on a documentary short that Donaldson had made much earlier in his career, and a movie that I'm not going to mention until the end of the episode because it's the answer to the trivia question. But on the other hand, he also made Cocktail, one of Tom Cruise's worst movies. He made Species, which I don't like much either. And he also made a lot of mediocre to okay movies in between, like Sleeping Dogs, and then The Bounty, which was purported as being closer to the story of the actual mutiny on the Bounty than any of the previous versions were. And while I admire the fidelity to the truth, I just wish the movie weren't so dull.
Ooh.
And also Marie, which actually was the first appearance that Fred Dalton Thompson ever made in a movie. He plays himself, playing a lawyer. And then White Sands, his remake of The Getaway, and then Dante's Peak, which was the other movie about a volcano besides Volcano. Overall, he's had a pretty mixed career, but just as I've said about the auteur theory, that one of the problems is that its adherents seem to insist that any director whom they appoint as being a genuine and great auteur never makes a bad movie. And that has happened. The corollary is also true, that people who often turn out products that are not great can all of a sudden hit a home run. And I think Donaldson really hit one in No Way Out.
So even a blind squirrel finds a nut once in a while, huh? Okay.
Right. Now, one of the reasons, the main reason, I would argue, aside from how well-structured the script is Kevin Costner. Now, Alfred Hitchcock, who we're going to talk about in a couple of episodes from now, once said that a star, or casting a star in the lead role of your movie, will save you 10 to 15 pages of exposition. And, you know, that's certainly true that, you know, if you have someone whose image corresponds to the role, that you're going to, that you don't really need to do much in the way of setting up the character that way, because the star's baggage will take care of it for you. You know, the classic example I always use to illustrate, and I'm going to bring this movie up again when we talk about Hitchcock, is the movie version of The Fugitive, when Harrison Ford is standing at the height of that big old waterfall and Tommy Lee Jones has him at gunpoint, and Ford leaps into the water instead and manages to survive. You know, you cast any other actor in that role, then the audience would be throwing popcorn at the screen saying, oh, come on. But this is Han Solo and Indiana Jones who's leaping off of the top of the waterfall. And so we accept that he will leap off and will survive.
Of course.
But what's not mentioned when talking about, you know, how a star can save 10 to 15 pages of exposition is that also allows you to play around with the image if you want to and the star is willing. Now, the movie that Costner appeared in just a couple months before No Way Out came out was the movie version of The Untouchables, the TV show from the 60s starring Robert Stack as Elliot Ness. And Costner played Elliot Ness in the movie. And I am not a big fan of the movie, though I've grown to appreciate it more than I did when I initially saw it. I initially hated the movie. And one of the reasons why I hated it was Costner playing Ness as this true blue, dewy-eyed guy, all-American hero type person, instead of how Ness actually was. And yet, if it hadn't been for The Untouchables, casting Costner in No Way Out, I don't think would have worked as well as it did, because he was seen as this true blue all-American hero in his previous movie. I think that's one of the reasons why we accept him as Tom Farrell. I mean, he does commit a heroic act in the movie of saving the guy when he's about to fall off the boat as well because of the storm. But, you know, every frame of the movie until the end, we are rooting for him. Mm-hmm. And that's why when the movie reveals that he's actually a Soviet mole, that reveal comes as such a shock.
And hits as hard as it does. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, so, you know, there is something to be said for playing with someone's image. You know, if you had made this movie, say, 10, 15 years ago, Robert Redford would have been perfect. And that's why Costner works so well in the role. Now, he's not the only actor who does well in the movie. I think everyone, including the people we've already discussed, but also Gene Hackman, does very well as Bryce. You know, I love the first scene with Farrell in his office when he's giving them the briefing. You know, he gets good lines, like when he's talking about how Farrell's going to be a liaison to the intelligence community, and then he gives that little Hackman chuckle.
Yeah.
And he says, calling that a bunch of piranhas a community is one of life's little ironies. And then at the end of the scene, after Farrell has said to him again, yes, sir, he says, let's cut the protocol. In the absence of a demurral, I'll assume all of your answers are in the affirmative. And Farrell starts to say something and realizes, oh, yeah, I don't say anything.
Just keep quiet, yeah.
That's really effective. And at the same time, we have to show how venal and weak he really is. And Hackman does that well. And Sean Young, I got to say, although she hasn't always been a great actress, I think she works well as Susan.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I bought into her right away. I just liked her. And it wasn't just a matter of like, you know, well, you know, she got all sexy with Kevin Costner. No, I really bought into their relationship. I felt that they did feel for each other. And as, you know, Farrell says at the end, I did fall in love with her. You know, he really kind of threw himself into the role, and it worked out poorly for her, unfortunately. But, you know, the fact is that she carried it off, and she carried it off well. And, you know, even in some of these areas where she is trying to do that femme fatale thing, there's like that scene early in the party where he's like, you know, where she says to the guy, look, if you want to look down my dress, you need to grow a couple of inches.
And that guy, by the way, is played by Josh Mostel, Zero's son.
I thought he looked familiar, but I didn't look to place him. But you know, and I understand that there are other times when she was like a little bit problematic on sets and whatever, and I'd never heard any stories about her in this particular case, but I did like it, and I liked her to the point where, as I was supposed to, I did feel bad when her character died, and I was like, wow, this relationship ended way too soon.
Yes. And then also George Zunza and Jason Bernard are good as well in their small roles, as is Marshall Bell as one of the Contras. And Dennis Berkley as the guy who rents out the yacht to Farrell and Susan. He would team up with Costner again in Tin Cup. And he's an actor I always liked as well. So do you have anything else you want to add before I answer the trivia question?
No, we have been down quite the lengthy road with this one. I think I've exhausted everything.
Yeah, so that movie that Kevin Costner and Roger Donaldson made 13 years after this movie came out.
It was not Cocktail, right?
13 Days.
Yeah.
13 Days. That's the movie about the Cuban Missile Crisis, with Bruce Greenwood as John F. Kennedy and Costner doing a controversial Boston accent as Kevin O'Connell, who was Kennedy's chief of staff or chief assistant, depending on who you talk to. Now, this is the part where we tell you that both No Way Outs are available on DVD, but if you prefer to stream them, the 1950 No Way Out, you can rent or buy through Amazon. You can rent through Amazon, DirecTV, Google Play, Vudu, and YouTube, and you can buy it through all of those platforms as well as Apple TV, whereas the 1987 No Way Out, you can currently stream on Max, which is what HBO Max used to be called, as well as DirecTV and Amazon if you subscribe to Max through them, or you can rent or buy it through Amazon, Apple TV, and most other streaming services. And coming up next time, it's going to be our second episode of movies with the same title, but which are different movies. This time, we're going to talk about two movies that are called The Loving. One is from 1970 and was directed by Irvin Kershner, and the other was from 2016 and was written and directed by Jeff Nichols. And the 1970 Loving can be rented or bought through Amazon, Apple TV, and other major streaming services, whereas the 2016 Loving, you can stream through Netflix. Netflix, either with or without commercials, depending on how you've subscribed to them, or you can rent or buy it through most other streaming services. And we have our own webpage, which is wordsandmovies.com, and you can either leave a comment on one of our posts, or you can email us through wordsandmoviespod@gmail.com, or you can leave a comment on our Facebook page, which is facebook.com/wordsandmovies. And myself, Sean Gallagher, you can also find on Facebook. How about you, Claude?
Yeah, you can find me on that Book of Face under my own name, Claude Call, and you can also check out me other podcast, How Good It Is, at howgooditis.com.
So thanks for listening, everyone. We'll see you next time.
Thank you so much. Alex, please carry us out.
This is your announcer, Alexander Blackman, with the closing credits. This show was produced by Sean Gallagher and Claude Call, with editing and post-production by Claude, with some help from Ophonic. Audio clips are used under fair use rules for commentary and educational framing. Everything else is copyrighted by Claude Call and Sean Gallagher. The theme music you're bopping along to right now is by Solar Flare and is used under a Creative Commons license. Podcast hosting is provided by Spotify for podcasters. Thanks for listening. We'll talk to you soon.